State Education Committee to order. We're going to begin with a public hearing on Senate Bill 405. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 405. Jan, would you give us a brief overview, and we'll invite up our witnesses.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 405 eliminates the requirement that public charter schools participate in the public employees retirement system, PERS, and also changes the audit standard for public charter schools. Presently, it's the municipal audit standard, and this would change it to something that the proponents believe would be more appropriate. You might, since he's a sponsor, isn't he?
He wanted to be last.
You might want to have him call up first.
I don't know.
We're going to invite Rob Kramer up first to explain what the issue is, and then we probably have him back as a rebuttal witness. Anyway, at this point, Mr. Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rob Kramer. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Charter School Service Center. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this bill today. As you know, I'm a supporter of this bill. Two simple things that it does. Number one, it changes the audit requirement for public charter schools. Rather than to have a municipal audit, it simply changes that wording and requires an annual fiscal audit or financial audit as opposed to a municipal audit. Now, I've worked with charter schools over the last several years in my capacity at the Oregon Charter School Service Center, and none of the schools that I work with are seeking to escape any accountability. In fact, they dearly want the oversight and the fiscal oversight that an annual audit would require. However, these are not municipal entities, and I think it was an oversight in the original legislation that said that they will comply with the municipal audit statutes. It is far more appropriate for public charter schools to have a financial audit because they are small nonprofit corporations, and it only makes sense for them to have a financial versus a municipal audit. There will be people here today to testify on that point who are far more knowledgeable than I about the distinctions between a municipal audit and a financial audit, so I'll defer my any expansion on that testimony to them. But I would like to stress that nobody is trying to escape any accountability. It's simply what makes the most sense for a public charter school in order to get a very clear picture of their monthly, quarterly, or annual financial status. The second element of this bill is to, in essence, make it optional for public charter schools whether or not their employees are members of PERS and pay into a PERS account. There are lots of reasons for this, which you will hear today from people who are developing charter schools or have developed and are operating charter schools. The upshot is that, again, when the law was crafted, we knew that a lot of teachers who would be coming from the district-operated public school system into a public charter school would want to stay in PERS. And we wanted the law to allow that to happen, and so the law was written to allow that to happen. I believe it was an oversight in the original law that it required all employees to be in PERS, even those who don't want to be. We've had instances of charter schools here in Oregon in which every single employee asked to be released from PERS, but they were not allowed to. The current law allows a charter school to ask for a waiver from the State Board of Education of any provision of the law, except for one section of laws that are not waivable. In point of fact, the State Board has ruled that it does not have the authority to waive the PERS provision in the statute unless, if and only if, the district that is sponsoring a charter school goes with the charter school and jointly requests the waiver from the PERS requirement. So in essence, the charter school has to convince the district to go along with the request. And there are several instances now in Oregon of the districts not doing that, saying, no, we will not go with you. We will not share this request with you. And that case, I think now, one of them is being litigated. One of them has resulted in a charter school having been closed down. There are several other reasons for releasing the charter schools from PERS requirement, one of which is they operate on significantly less per student dollars, roughly 50% on an all funds basis in per student dollars spent by charter schools than district schools. And as you well know, with the controversy swirling about this building in the PERS law, next year, with no changes, if there are no changes to the existing system, schools will have to pay 24.58% of payroll into PERS next year. Now, one question would be, if we're going to let charter schools out of PERS, maybe we should let district schools out of PERS too. And that is a notion that I would heartily endorse. I don't see how our schools will ever be sustainable if they're paying 25% of payroll into a retirement fund. They will never be sustainable. And in fact, in the private sector, a generous pension contribution is 10% of payroll. Many of you who work in the private sector, if your employer were to put 10% of your salary into a pension account, that would be very, very generous. Yet we expect our school districts to be fiscally manageable, putting 25% of payroll into PERS. That will not happen and cannot happen. If we were able to get PERS down to 10%, rather than 25%, which it will be next year, virtually every funding problem in every school district would disappear overnight. That's the extent of the problem in PERS. Now, I'm not up here to talk at length about PERS issue. It's an issue being discussed in a different committee. But if we can allow a release of one type of charter school from the PERS issue, then I think that's a good start. And I would hope we could maybe expand upon that and then get some other schools released as well. Thanks very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We will more than likely call Mr. Kramer back. But thank you, Rob, and we will continue with other witnesses at this point. Proponents, Susan Giles, William Lay, and Catherine. Is that right? Or am I reading that wrong?
It's Susan Gillis for me.
Gillis. Okay. Gillis works for me. Yeah.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Susan Gillis, and I'm the developer and the administrator of a to-be, hopefully, public charter middle school in Eugene, Oregon. And I was asked to come up and talk to you about these issues, so I'm here today. I also know there's a CPA in the background, and I'm sure she knows more about the audit issues than I do, but I'm going to talk to them about them briefly as well. And some of what I'm going to say is also what Rob just said, that you're going to be getting a lot of dittoing here, I think, on this. I also have given copies of what I brought up to the lady over there for distribution. Oh, you get them already, huh? I've never done this before, so I don't know. Okay. So with regard, I'll start out with the muni audit issues. And on my board is a woman by the name of Martha Woodland, and she is a CPA, and she has done and is licensed to do municipal audits of schools, and she has done many of them. And so I conferred with her as well before I came up here. And the purpose of a municipal audit in the laws themselves, it was originally designed for municipalities who had, quote, fund, lots and lots of different and various funds for which they wanted individual accounting of. In a regular public school, there's typically at least 10 individual funds of revenues from various sources that come in. And each one of those funds has to have its own bank account, its own balance sheet, and its own income statement. And also, they don't allow for, except at year-end audit summary accounting, a consolidated corporate picture of all of the funds together netted out against each individual revenue and expense. It's really called fund accounting for the very reason of municipalities. Individual charter schools don't have a large number of varying funds for their revenues. We have 99% of our revenue comes from ODE State School Fund per pupil ADMW. So we have just really one fund to keep track of. And we want, as business owners, my degree is in finance and management, and my minor was accounting. I want, as a business owner and a person responsible for the trust of all those funds, I want to know on a monthly basis the profit and loss position of my revenues against their correlated expenses each period related to one another. I want to know that every month, and I want to know it at the end of the year as well. But that information for people who run businesses, not just lots of money in against money out, inflows and outflows, we make decisions based on that information in a timely fashion, and we set up the bookkeeping to accommodate that. Schools don't do that. They just measure inflows against outflows, and they end up with a fund balance at the end. And the ground rule for them is you can't have more outflows than you have inflows. But it's not a tool used like business people do to evaluate what areas you can tweak, what areas you can't. So also, as much as I can remember without looking at my notes for a moment, the charter school law, ORS 297-435, that states that exemptions from audit, financial statement and bonding required, and Section 3A reads, total receipts from all sources and expenditures for all purposes, including money obtained from borrowing and money expended for debt retirement, exceeded $150,000 but did not exceed $500,000 for the year. So that law, when it was written and is still on the books, said that for municipalities that don't have $500,000 a year of revenue, they're not going to be required to do municipal audit law. They're going to be allowed to be an exception to the municipal audit law. Charter schools meet that standard, the general charter school. Most of us do not have over $500,000 in revenue for the year. The reason for that is we get about $4,000 per pupil, and the average school has less than 100 students in it. So that's a $400,000 revenue. So that in and of itself on the books already stipulates that we should not have to be required to comply with municipal audit law accounting. The other expense that's horrendous involved in municipal audit law is the computer software. People who have been in business a long time, we like to have computerized accounting systems, not manual bookkeeping systems. And if you're required to do municipal audit, you definitely have to have computerized accounting systems. To purchase the software needed to required to output a municipal audit financial statement costs around $10,000 minimum to $20,000 a year. If you were not required to do the municipal audit, but you were required to output a financial statement according to GAAP, you could purchase software for as little as $250 a year. The other requirement that $10,000 software package it requires, and the way that the books are required to be kept under that municipal audit reporting, requires CPA-level bookkeeping. So most of the charter schools end up being forced to outsource their bookkeeping system and not have someone who can come in to the office at $15 to $20 an hour to maintain the bookkeeping system. They all, in Eugene that I know of, outsource the bookkeeping, and they have to pay $75 to $150 an hour for the bookkeeping services, and it's completely unnecessary.
Mr. Chair, Senator Perioli.
I just wondered if I can get an understanding from the panel of the difference between a certified public accountant and a bookkeeper.
Well, certified public accounting, that person has like a college degree certification. They have taken an exam that's, you know, 3 days and 5 hours a day to qualify for that. Under the municipal audit law, you are required to have a certified CPA perform a municipal audit financial statement.
Paul, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Perioli.
There's a fundamental difference, though, between just bookkeeping services provided by a good bookkeeper who may be doing the work just absolutely identical to a CPA. Do you know what the fundamental difference is?
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with that.
Mr. Chairman, a certified public accountant is a fiduciary. they have a far higher standard of performance and practice. They're held to a completely different standard in terms of recovery and prosecution in case of fraud or malfeasance.
Well, that's true. That is true. And when they sign on your tax return, they are very much held liable for what they're...
And the reason that's true, Mr. Chairman, is that they've subjected themselves to a higher standard of training. They hold themselves out as a different kind of accounting provider. They are not just responsible for adding the columns, but they're also responsible for legal compliance and use of funding. So I guess I'm not persuaded that the bookkeeper that you have doing your P&Ls monthly could provide the same kind of services that CPAs do. And I wanted to know if you were applying that kind of a standard to the problem at hand, which is you've got a lot of people trusting you, you've got a lot of money on the table, and every day or every week somewhere in the state of Oregon, some bookkeeper takes off, runs south, cashes the checks, takes the money.
Well, Mr. Chair,
and I want to know how you protect yourself from that kind of an activity without a CPA.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farioli, is that how you say it?
You're not excluded.
You're not excluded in using a CPA to do your bookkeeping as a charter school,
yep.
But the mandates under which a CPA charges you money for a municipal audit, yep, versus a CPA that's doing regular fiscal, business, financial accounting, there's a huge difference in what they charge an hour.
Mr. Chairman, I am persuaded that there's a difference between the municipal audit, and perhaps it's not the standard to which we need to hold charter schools, but I'm not at all persuaded that CPAs don't need to be involved in the administration of public funds for charter schools.
And I sure hope you don't think that I'm saying that.
I just had to ask the clarifying question, ma'am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So there was... Again, the same issue of the costs for outputting a municipal audit versus a fiscal business management, whether done by a CPA or not. The cost of preparing one balance sheet, one income statement, is far less, no matter who prepares it, than it is the standard under a municipal audit requirement. And again, it's for the reason of having huge dollar amounts of money in large numbers of individual funds that have to be individually reported. That's all I have to say about the audit issue. Can I talk about the PERS, too?
Please.
As a startup charter school developer, I'm required by Oregon statute to prove financial viability and sustainability for the school. Given the PERS retirement system financial condition at this time, I do not feel that I'd be meeting this very valid standard by opting to put our employee retirements in this system at this time. Given that there's a $15 billion deficit in the unfunded liability of the PERS system, and that the uncertainty of the resolution of that problem does not appear to be short-term, it doesn't meet that standard that we're required to meet from my point of view about the retirement system. Also, in charter schools, you have non-traditional employee situations where they're not necessarily signing on for 15 to 20 years like they are in the regular districts, and they are choosing not to want to be part of PERS membership. They don't feel that they have a clarity of what the benefits will be, are. They feel, the teachers that I've been interviewing for teaching for my school, feel that there's very large uncertainty for them as to getting any benefit out of it over a long term. They are aware of the huge amount of current people, 7,400 PERS members retired recently, and there's large uncertainty about the whole system. So they are looking forward to me setting up something similar to a 401k style retirement system under a nonprofit organization. They're called 403bs. And so I completely support the option of having a choice that they may or may not. In the future, through court litigations, whatever happens in the PERS system, it gets worked out such that it's a viable system and an option for sustainability in employees in my school. I would be happy to look at it at that time. And this bill would allow that as an option. And that's all I have to say. Are there any questions?
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please.
Chairman Starr and committee, my name is Catherine Land. I'm the League of Oregon Charter Schools president and the operator of a public charter school in Eugene, Oregon. What I prepared for you this morning is in a, you'll see as a spreadsheet here. I'm looking at facts and figures. And in order to do that, I had to make up three hypothetical middle schools. In, of course, I used Eugene's state school fund as a sample since that's where we're from. But I want you to take a look at what I presented here. And what I'm, the bottom line, I think I'm just going to cut right to the chase. Rob and Susan both made some good points about the PERS. What I want you to see is if you take a look at this hypothetical situation, and the notes on this will explain to you further, if you care to read it further at some later point, in more depth, what I'm meaning by this these figures here. I did a comparison on these hypothetical schools between three types of schools. A district-owned and operated and sponsored charter school, which is wholly supported by the district, an independent charter school that has no district affiliation and is not connected in any way, fiscally or otherwise, to the district other than its loose sponsorship, and then a second type of independent charter school, a special purpose charter school. And the reason I brought up both all three of these is because there's a vast difference in funding between a district-sponsored charter school and an independent charter school, and then those with special that work with special needs children and are specialty schools are impacted in different ways. As you can see from this, on the first page, it's I have to excuse myself. When I made up this matrix, I estimated based on Eugene School District's prediction that the PERS costs would be going up by 40%. And currently, if they pick up the employer's part only and the PERS administration, it's only 13.89%, if that's all it is. Current. I guessed at their 40% is what they told us in a meeting they anticipated PERS going up. Rob's figure is probably more correct. And so you're looking at the difference between 17.04% and 24.58%. But since this is hypothetical anyway, and we're really not looking at real numbers, we're looking at fictitious schools and comparative numbers. I simplify this to the point of almost ridiculousness, because to understand something funding so complex is what we're talking about here, and to be able to compare them on figures and simplify them to a 10-minute or less speech would be almost impossible. So the line I want to focus on is the operating expenses line, and I want to take you down on that line and take a look. Considering all things being equal, the district charter schools will get full funding on the ADM, not at the Senate Bill 100 rate, but at the higher ADM rate allowed all schools. If you see on page 3, you can take a look at that figure. The formula revenue per ADMW for 4J school district is $5,201. That district charter school would more than likely receive that amount since they are a district school. An independent charter school, whether it be a special purpose or otherwise, will only get 80% of the $5,073 that are allotted for Senate Bill 100, and that excludes transportation costs. I think that's what the difference is between those two figures. Considering everything, if you looked at the difference between PERS and a private retirement plan, the difference is massive, for specialty charter schools and devastating to some degree for those who aren't. You look at the difference in what services can be provided by the dollars that you've got left to operate on once you've paid personnel costs. And mind you, on the notes it explains that we are looking at a school of 150 middle schoolers. All three are the 150 students, all have relatively the same number of staff, five teachers for 30 students in each classroom. The one difference here that I need to point out is the special purpose charter school, such as the Pioneer Youth Corps in Eugene, they don't have five staff members per classroom. They have 10. For five classrooms, they have 10 employees. In each classroom is a teacher and an aide. Because of the type of students that Pioneer Youth Corps takes, they have to have a teacher and an aide, or we'd have teachers running out the door screaming at the end of the day. We work with at-risk kids, kids that are, well, put it this way, severely in need of behavioral modification and severely in need of assistance, constant assistance. So the dollars and figures that you see there are, of course, higher. The bottom line, is it going to hurt charter schools? Yeah. Is it going to hurt public schools? Yeah. A higher raise in PERS is going to hurt public schools, whether they be charter or they be a standard district school. Are the impacts on charter schools going to be higher? Absolutely. And special purpose schools like the Pioneer Youth Corps, it's going to be, that right there can determine whether that school will survive or not. You'd raise it up to 25%. There's no operating funds left unless they go out and beg on street corners or get grants from other sources. As it is right now, many charter schools are exactly forced to go fundraise for majority of their money anyway. Is it fair? It's only fair that we've allowed people to choose. It's a whole thing about choice. The Pioneer Youth Corps staff voted. They didn't want PERS. They wanted private so they could have private retirement funds that could be portable should they choose to leave and work in maybe another charter school or another private school or someplace not within the public education system. Were they allowed the choice? No. Their vote counted for nothing. I think with what Susan said and what Rob said, you've heard enough about PERS, at least from my point of view. I would like to segue right into the issue of the audits. I didn't plan to say anything about the audits today, but I will say one thing. I do support some of what Susan said. Having been there in the trenches and having undergone an audit this year, she wasn't too far wrong when she said they're astronomically expensive. In 1999, before we chartered, we had a corporate audit that cost us $2,500. Well, when we became a charter school the following year, our audit went up to $3,500. This year, with GASB 34 municipal requirements added to the mix, it cost us $11,000 because we paid $4,500 for the initial charter school audit. Then we had to pay another $3,500 for an individual corporate audit on our nonprofit status to meet with our private lenders, our private grantees' requirements. Well, you got 45 and 35. What's that come to? $8,000. And then it cost us, oh, gee, I didn't count that right, another $7,000 above that to hire a CPA to come in and go through our complete accounting system, revamp it, reorganize it, and bring it into GASB 34 compliance so that next year's audit won't cost us $6,000. So we haven't finished that, by the way. Our CPA is still working with us debugging the GASB 34 stuff. Municipal audits would not be so onerous if the GASB 34 law requirement wasn't involved. But GASB 34 makes a headache for municipalities, and you can imagine the headache it would make for a little tiny charter school that has one-nth of the resources available to a large municipality. The realities are that it's very high impact, And we voice our granting agencies and our foundations that have given us money over the years. We're perfectly happy with our nonprofit audit. It accounts for every penny that we have. Our CPA is a duly licensed CPA that has done those every year. And it's been accepted by the Oregon Audits Division. It's no questions, no problems. So the question is, is it important that we have a municipal audit? Not really. Even in the large scheme of things, where the districts have to have their charter schools or a component unit of the district, all they have to do is have the bottom line to add to their whole report package. It requires them taking one little number, popping it into their report, and saying, this is what our charter schools, A, charter school A, reported this year. That's a very simple matter. So why expect a charter school with little money to go out and spend literally thousands of dollars to do this? And like I said, we don't even know the outcome yet. We haven't received the last accounting bill yet. So, you know, the costs are onerous. That's all I can say.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Please. Senator Starr, members of the committee, Education Committee. I am neither a counselor or neither a CPA nor an accountant. I don't know anything about Gadsby 34. I don't know anything about audits. But I do know about people. I'm a clinical counselor and a social worker. I've worked with at-risk youth for some 30 years now. And I'm the executive director of the Pioneer Youth Corps, which is a special charter school that works with at-risk and marginalized middle and high school kids. We started a charter school several years ago because charter schools were designed as proving grounds for new ideas, new methods, and new learning styles. Financially, charter schools are already handicapped by receiving less than the overall funding that district schools receive. And that's the way the law was written. In spite of that, I think charter schools are doing a pretty good job. I know we're doing a lot of innovative things. We use a lot of used furniture. We spend a lot of time and weekends repairing and repainting and oiling and fixing and putting in extra screws, but we save money that way. But placing the pressure of a high-priced PERS system on a charter school is an unfair burden. My school has decided and has talked with our staff who already receive considerably less in pay than many of them did when they worked for district schools. We've decided that it's more important for them to receive medical benefits, and we give them the best medical package that we can. We do not charge them for that medical package. We pick up the fee for both the employee and for the employee's family. For many of my young staff members who have a growing family, that's very, very important. For many of my older staff members getting on in years, that's equally important. It seems like the older you get, the harder it's getting to get medical insurance. And we find it very important to cover our staff with that. We give them visual and dental and full medical and prescription coverage. Again, I don't know anything about the accounts, but the people who work with that in my program tell me that we have one of two choices. Either we can pay them PERS, we can pay them retirement, or we can pay them medical benefits. I don't want to have to make that kind of a choice. I don't want my employees to have to make that kind of a choice. Right now, our school brings in enough funds from the district money to keep our doors open and keep our employees paid, keep the lights on. We have to go out and find the rest of the money for textbooks and chairs and tables and pens and pencils, and that's fine. But I don't want to have to make the kind of choice of whether I'm going to give my employees retirement or whether I'm going to give them medical insurance simply because that's the way the law is written. I want them to be able to have a choice. I want to be able to charter schools to have the choice that they were designed to have, whether it's choice in the kind of textbooks that they use or whether it's choice in the kind of salaries that they pay. That's an important part of the charter school system. Some of the charter schools, on the other hand, they can't afford this program, maybe because their employee costs are less, or maybe because they don't have to pay for a building, or maybe because they're a converted charter school. They're a public school that converted over. That's a good law. The people who are on PERS should not have to lose everything that they put into it so far. That's very, very important. It's very important for them. All I'm saying is not that they shouldn't be on the PERS system, but that each charter school should be allowed to make that decision rather than have to make the kind of decisions that I'm concerned about. I think that's part of what charter schools were created for, is the idea to make decisions and make choices that are going to fit their staff, their employees, their families, their students. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. And we've got Lori Wimmer. Lori, would you like to come up?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, representing 45,000 members. And we're here today to oppose Senate Bill 405 for two reasons. We oppose both of the provisions put forth in this bill. With respect to the accounting provisions, we believe that the lapse of accountability that this language would institute is provides a loophole to drive a school bus through. We believe that if the system is expensive or so outrageous to honor the municipal accounting standards, then why have school districts adhere to those terms? We believe that these are still public monies going to public schools, and that the same rigorous standards for financial accountability ought to apply to all such public schools, whether they be charter schools or the traditional program. We also unequivocally oppose removing the must from the statute with respect to the PERS participation by charter schools. And there are a number of reasons for that. I'm not a PERS expert, but I consulted those who are. And this is a state's interest kind of argument. The reason all public entities, excepting police and fire, who have an equal to or better than standard they still must adhere to in terms of providing retirement benefits, but all public entities must be PERS members once they've elected in, is that the stability of the entire system for PERS, provision of PERS, is at stake. Once you start carving out this group or that, this area of public service or that could opt out, you end up diluting the strength of the pool. And though perhaps charter schools themselves might not significantly be detrimentally diluting the pools for the schools, over time, that slippery slope would lead to destabilizing the PERS system. We don't need to do that. We also believe that rather than enhancing mobility, it would actually be a deterrent to mobility for public educators who might wish to, for the purpose of exploring innovation in their teaching methods, be interested in going into the PERS system. And by the way, when Senate Bill 100 was passed, that was one of the issues on the record for having PERS as a part of that system, is that If a public school teacher were to leave a traditional program in order to be hired by a charter school district, they would have a disincentive for doing so if that were a charter school that did not offer PERS, if this law were to pass, because they would have all those service credits that they were walking away from. And if they then left the charter school to move somewhere else, that would also be a problem because of all those years that they may have spent in a charter school not accruing the service credits toward PERS for that period of time. It would certainly not be an inducement. So for all of those reasons, and also because we believe that it doesn't make sense on a public policy level to offer different levels of benefits, given that the school district is the employer for the purposes of PERS and not the charter school, offering different levels of benefits for some employees than for others within a district is not good public policy. So So we believe that the charter school law already offers a more, shall I say, relaxed standard of accountability with respect to licensure and so forth, and to also have a more relaxed standard of accountability with respect to these two issues, we would not be in support of. Thank you.
Questions?
Senator Perriello. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What does the municipal standard do for a school district in the county? What's accomplished by that standard? How rigorous is it? To what does it apply?
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrelly, I wish I were the right person to ask that question. I have consulted with one of my colleagues who's homesick, Jim Green, who's done a lot of research on this, and it's my hope that if this doesn't move today, and you could ask him that question directly, but I think there might even be other people in the audience who are better able to answer that question for you. I'm certainly not an expert.
And Mr. Chairman, the question of the PERS, the whole issue of PERS, the exception to this observation I'm about to make, and I'm not sure it's accurate, would be those people that were moving from current or permanent employee employment status with a school district into a charter school. But I guess I'm going to suggest that there are no Tier 1 charter school employees. Is that correct or incorrect? Unless they were previously employed with the school district. Because Tier 1 ended in 1996, and Tier 2 started in right there in June, the end of the fiscal year in 96. So there's only Tier 2 PERS members at charter schools unless they moved from the regulars. Okay. The language in this bill is permissive. It says may. It doesn't say shall. So this charter school may continue to offer PERS, or it may offer a different program. So I guess the question I've got is, given that there's no Tier 1 people in charter schools that aren't already vested in PERS, and therefore permanently in PERS, what would be the harm in letting charter schools, as a matter of fact, isn't there a positive benefit into removing the liability from PERS for certain employees? We're trying to buy them out right now. I mean, we're trying to do anything we can to cut the cost and the liability for PERS. How would this not benefit the PERS remaining Tier 1 and Tier 2 members?
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrelly, if I understand your question correctly, one of the points you made was that if they were to move into the charter school after being in the district, that this wouldn't in any way hurt them because they'd already be members, but their service credits would not be credited to their account for the time that they would be spending in the charter school for the remainder of their career or for whatever period of service that would be. That would be a detriment to their overall benefit.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with that, but in fact they would undertake the work in the charter schools knowledgeably. I mean, somebody certainly would suggest that, look, you know, you might want to come to the charter school, but you're not going to get credit, service credits.
Right. And to the second part, Mr. Chair and Senator Farrelly, the idea that it would be optional, if the charter school administration chooses to make it optional with existing charter schools where people are already employed, that's not the employee's option. That's the administration's option. That's the point.
Mr. Chairman, these teachers... either this is an at-will state or they have a contract. So the point is it would be negotiable with the teacher. So I don't know of any school district administration that can unilaterally change a contract.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrelly, as I said, we also argued that it was a compelling state interest for all public entities to remain in PERS for the stability of the system.
I think we're going to see that, Mr. Chairman, not to be argumentative, but I think we're going to see that compelling interest tested. I have a bill to buy out vested Tier 1 members who've been severed from the system for a period of time, and that is supported by PERS, and it's going to save, I hope, about $200 million. So I guess my thought was that the compelling public interest at this point would be to reduce costs in PERS.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrelly, perhaps that's an argument for another committee. We remain opposed to the bill.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Well, Jim Green was going to testify. Okay, I'm looking for someone from the administrative school administration's point of view.
I think there's someone here.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We have...
Chris Oliveira. And I'd like to...
Joni
Gillis hasn't yet testified. Yes, would you come on up, occupy one of these seats, and we'll have Rob Kramer come back and take the third seat.
Al Shannon.
Oh, wait a minute. Mr. Shannon, you're coming forward to also testify. Thank you. Please join us. Didn't have your name down here. Yes. First.
You want me, Chris?
Yes,
okay.
Please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. I am Chris Oliveira. I am a CPA with almost 10 years' experience auditing nonprofit organizations that receive substantial amounts of government funding. I also serve on the board of a public charter school in Tigard, and I am pretty familiar with governmental financial reporting requirements. I attend many, many school district board meetings. I follow their financials. I like to know what's going on in my schools. I am not going to speak on the PERS provisions. I'm only here to testify on the audit provisions. And also, at the end, I'm going to give you a summary of my testimony so you don't have to write everything down. I have three main concerns about requiring charter schools to undergo municipal audits. The first of those concerns is that I simply don't feel, as a CPA, that it is the appropriate audit form for them. And the reason that I think that is that, number one, there is no specific guidance in the audit literature that says charter schools need to report under either financial audits, meaning GAAS audits, or municipal audits, or governmental auditing standards. I have contacted the FASB, I contacted the GASB, I've talked to the Secretary of State, and my conclusion has been that a nonprofit charter school is not a public corporation that would be subjected to governmental reporting requirements. And the GASB and the FASB have agreed upon a definition of a governmental organization that would follow the governmental requirements. And the main points in their definition, it has to be either an organization that is created for the administration of public affairs by the state or owned by the state. That's one criteria. Well, all nonprofit organizations are created for public purposes. Many of them use substantial amounts of public dollars to serve their purposes. The IRS doesn't tend to like nonprofits that serve private interests. They tend to do things like revoke their tax-exempt status. It's not okay. All nonprofits are public, or serving the public in one way or another. The other criteria that is in the GASB-FASB definition is a governmental organization is going to have a popular election of officers, or the board members are going to be appointed by a government. That is not the case with public charter schools. Another one is that the organization is subject to unilateral dissolution by a government. That is not the case with charter schools. It is possible for a government to revoke their charter, but that doesn't put an end to the organization. It means that they may, if they want to turn around and open a private school, if they can go out and raise the funds to do that, they can do that. They have to turn back their assets that were purchased with public monies. They need to turn those back to the public. But outside of that, they're not over if they lose their charter. And the final criteria in this definition is that a governmental organization is going to have taxing authority or bonding authority of some sort. Public charter schools do not have that. So I don't believe that public charter schools meet the criteria to be classified as governmental organizations under the accounting rules. The second main point I'm going to make is that, actually before I get to that, I just wanted to point out there are many, many examples of nonprofits that receive substantial public monies and that report under the nonprofit model. A HUD project is a very good example of that. They receive a lot of support from HUD when they're starting up, and their revenues are regulated by HUD. They can't just go out and raise their rents to whatever they want, and yet they report using the nonprofit model. There are a lot of mental health organizations, drug and alcohol rehab organizations, that most of their funding comes either from the county or the state or the city. They all report using the nonprofit model. Albertina Kerr Center in Portland, Oregon, runs a school for kids with emotional troubles. They receive state funding for their school, but they don't have to use the governmental reporting models. They use the nonprofit model. Now I'll go to my second point, and that is that the cost of a municipal audit is substantially more than the cost of a regular gas audit, and somebody has already alluded to that cost. It is because there are additional procedures performed, and the biggest driver in the cost, in my opinion, is not so much the additional procedures, but the financial reporting that comes along with using the governmental reporting model. With all of the funds, all of the budgetary numbers, it leads for much longer and much more complex financial statements. The charter school also has to go out and purchase software that is capable of tracking these funds, tracking the budgetary funds, and putting GASB 34 in on top of that. It is much more expensive, and I don't feel that it's needed. My final point is that the governmental reporting model is not very understandable to the charter school board. I maintain that they are the primary user of these financials, and it is important to send the audit to ODE, to the state board, and to the school district, but they have much more sophisticated staff that are able to read and understand a nonprofit reporting model. To have a charter school trying to understand their financials that are based on fund accounting, where there is three different methods of accounting used in the same financial statement. The GASB 34 requires full accrual accounting. The individual funds require either modified accrual or cash basis accounting. And the budgetary accounting is different from those. I think it's very confusing for a charter school to try to grasp these three different methods of accounting that are used within their one organization. Another problem occurs when you have a nonprofit running a charter school that also has a lot of other programs going on, because then you have a situation where you've got the nonprofit using financial reporting for most of their programs, and then they've got to go and do something totally different for their charter school. And it leads to an example of what was mentioned before, where they had to go out and get two different audits for the same organization. That's pointless. I don't feel that a charter school should be subjected to that. A regular financial audit is sufficient to meet the needs of the public. If the legislature wants additional assurance, you can ask for specified procedures on top of a financial audit without mandating a municipal audit. If you want to know that the ADMW dollars, if you want a special procedure to test that, you can require that. But I don't feel that you need to require a full municipal audit for a nonprofit charter school. That is pretty much everything I had to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Senator Barry, Mr. Chairman, please. I did a pretty discreditable job of explaining why what is the higher standard of the certified public accountant, and I wondered if I could get a clarification on the differences just between accountants in accountancy and fiduciary duties of a certified public accountant.
Okay. Accountants can be pretty much anybody. A bookkeeper, accountants can be anybody with a four-year accounting degree, and they will not have taken the CPA exam, nor will they have worked for a couple of years in the industry to get experience. A CPA is licensed. We've taken the exam. We've worked in the industry. A bookkeeper really has no accrediting standards that they're following. They can go and take a class at PCC and hang out their shingle and call themselves a bookkeeper.
Mr. Chairman, I think that just reinforces my concern about the idea that I think there is a standard, at least at the level of CPA, that I think would be prudent and reasonable for charter schools. I'm not convinced that we need to go to the municipal standard of accounting for the format of that relationship. I just wanted to make sure it's on the record that I hope charter school operators continue to seek the services of CPA if they're allowed not to have to do the municipal form of accounting for their schools because of the licensure requirements and the higher standards that are available.
Thank you. Appreciate putting that on the record.
May I say something?
Yes, please.
It's my understanding that the bill does not remove the requirement for an audit, and so there will be a CPA involved in the charter school audit process.
Mr. Chair, I find that reassuring.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
My name is Joni Gillis, and I represent the Department of Education, and I have laryngitis, so please, I will try and be as clear as possible. First of all, our testimony on PERS is going to be very brief. The department's attorney general flagged this bill and wondered, he flagged it because of the interplay between Chapter 238, the PERS statute, and ORS 338, excuse me, the charter school statute, and wondered if the proposed language would have the intended effect that the bill wanted. He has spoken to the Senate Administrator, Jan McComb, and has suggested some more specific language. So that is the testimony that I have regarding PERS. In terms of the municipal audit, public charter schools are public entities, and they're entrusted with public funds. And the municipal audit, as I think everyone has spoken to, is a higher level of an audit, and which would provide for the protection of public interests. I now know more about gas audits and municipal audits than I probably ever want to know, and have spoken with several CPAs and also with OSBA and with the State Audit Division. And so that's where my information is coming from. The municipal audit, according to the folks that I did research with, they did not think it was that a municipal audit was not that much more cumbersome than a GAF audit, a generally accepted accounting standard audit. They reported, and this was an auditor that had done both GAF audits and municipal audits for charter schools, reported that it was approximately between $500 and $800 more to do a municipal audit than a GAF audit. So it would cost more. However, the municipal audit would ensure that there's a compliance with certain laws that a GAF audit would not. Examples would be the investment of public funds. Another example would be public contracting laws. And probably most important would be the ADM requirement. A GAF audit does not, although, like I believe Chris mentioned, there could be a requirement that an audit pick up ADM and to make sure that there's consistency in terms of how ADM is the average daily membership is reported. That is a requirement of a municipal audit. the State Audit Division, when they're asked the question, should we have a gas audit or should we have a municipal audit, they ask three basic questions. The first question is, were you created for a public purpose? The second question, are you supported by public funds? And the third question is, if you dissolve, do your assets go to another public entity? And their recommendation, when they talk to folks, they say if you answer yes to the first two and yes, they go to the third one, that they go to the assets go to another public entity, that you should have that would mean that you should have a municipal audit. I think in summary, the department's position is that the municipal audit is really one of the responsibilities that comes with being entrusted with public funds. And I would entertain any questions.
It's clearly answered our testimony that many organizations, private nonprofits, receiving public funds for their services are not subjected to this audit requirement. That in itself is ample evidence, I believe, that this is not a requirement.
Senator Starr, I received different information when I asked that of the State Audit Department. I said, could you give me some examples of some public entities that do not have municipal audits? And he could think of several that received some federal funds for, like, daycare, health kinds of treatments. In speaking to the Attorney General, there was also, he gave another example, but said that those were problematic, that some of the ones that did not have any municipal audit, that received public funds that didn't have any municipal audit, that there were some problems with those because there wasn't that higher standard and that consistency.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes, Mr. Shannon.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. My name is Al Shannon. I'm employed by the Oregon School Boards Association, but not necessarily representing them at this time. I've been called basically to support Joni if any technical things came up, but I do have a couple of comments if you have a moment. I've been around school budgets and audits for the last 25 years, and in looking at some of the basic differences between a municipal audit and a audit of generally accepted auditing standards, there's a schedule of requirements that the municipal auditor must go through when they do the audit. And let me just kind of go through, though. I think Senator Fairley kind of asked what the differences were. These are an administrative rule under the Secretary of State's Audit Division. The schedule starts with schedule of property transaction, probably does not apply to a charter school. Schedule of bonded or long-term indebtedness doesn't apply. Schedule of future requirements for retirement of bonded debt doesn't apply. Then we get down to one called other financial and statistical information. And this is the comparability of data that we get from charter schools to compare the data on how they're spending their funds as opposed to other public schools or other charter schools. So that's one that probably we would be helpful, but we would not be getting if this bill were to pass. Required disclosure and independent auditor's comments. This one probably would be covered if the auditor felt that there were weaknesses in internal control or weaknesses that they would feel an obligation to disclose that. The next one is collateral, and anytime public funds are used or invested and put with a security organization, they have to have collateral to base those up. So this would be something that if this law were to pass, they would not be required to disclose. Indebtedness is one. Budget is another one that's required. Insurance and fidelity. Fidelity bonds. They're people who are custodians of public funds are required to be bonded, and this would not be a required to be disclosure to look at. The next one is called programs funded from outside sources, and charter schools do receive a lion's share of their funding through the state school fund, and this is definitely one which we want to make sure that was looked at. Now, also, each charter school has a charter school agreement with its charterer, and under the municipal audit law, the auditor would be required to go back and look at that charter and then make sure all the expenditures and the programs were consistent with the charter that was established. So I think that's a fairly important schedule that that should be included. We don't have five-way funds. Joni already mentioned public contracting. The next one is the state school fund, and this was a requirement the legislature put in several years ago, requiring the auditors to go in and make sure the district was accounting for the state school fund properly. Now funds flow to the district via the state school fund, which is a headcount. So there's assurances that the charter school is counting the students correctly, as well as the public school. So that's the basis of my testimony. Just to describe the differences, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Yes.
Thank you. What form do you have that those figures in? Is that are those your own notes, or did you take that out of a manual of some kind? What? I'd like to have a copy of it. Is that...
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, I just printed off the administrative rules from the Secretary of State's office. I'd be happy to leave them with you at the end. I didn't make copies for everybody. My apologies. It was kind of an impromptu thing coming over. So,
thank you very much. No further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Oh,
Senator Perriola.
What I guess I'm hearing from Al is that... Well, most of the municipal audit format does not apply to charter schools. Some do. Some certainly do. And so the question is perhaps the approach in this bill might better be to specify that in the audit that is required, that will continue, that those issues be addressed by the CPA in the audit. In other words, if we're freeing the charter schools from the requirement to do the municipal audit format, if we don't specify some of the document or some of the details of the CPA audit, then some potentially important details might fall through the cracks. So I'm just wondering if that is what I'm hearing being suggested here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ferraioli, that certainly would be, would be better than exempting them totally from disclosure of those items.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. I'm going to invite Rob Kramer back up, give him a chance to respond to some of the issues that we've had. I proposed that at the beginning, and so I'm going to follow through with it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me back up. For the record, I'm Rob Kramer, Executive Director of the Oregon Charter School Service Center. I'd like to just briefly talk about two points, one being the point that Senator Ferraioli just brought up. I think that is a terrific suggestion. The problem with the municipal audit requirement is not so much that there are some things that the municipal audit calls for that do relate to charter schools business and should be involved in an audit in the charter schools business. The problem with the municipal audit is that it requires many, many things that are not at all related to the charter schools business, not the least of which is completely changing their accounting practices, as Chris Oliveira explained. And that is a huge, not just burden on charter schools, not just a costly burden, but it also tends to confuse the issue, because people who are on the boards of charter schools are not practiced in looking at a financial statement from a municipal audit with its fund accounting as opposed to financial accounting, and so they find it very hard to manage their own organization. So I would suggest that perhaps if we were to amend this bill to specifically add back or add into an audit requirement those things that Mr. Shannon suggested would disappear were we not forced to comply with the municipal audit, we might be able to come to a compromise and have a financial audit structure that does include those things in the municipal audit that apply to charter schools. I think that is a terrific suggestion, something that I am sure that all charter schools would be more than happy to go along with. On the question of PERS, it was suggested that compelling charter schools to participate in PERS was a matter of stability for PERS. I have to confess, I kind of smiled when I heard that, because PERS has a $15 billion unfunded liability. It is, if anything, unstable currently. And in fact, as again Senator Farioli suggested, perhaps exempting, opting out, or buying people out of the PERS program is something that will enhance stability rather than create instability. And I think that this bill would, in a very, very small way, certainly, but it would help move us towards that end. With that, I think that the people who testified did a far better job than I could at addressing some of the points that were brought up and against this bill.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Are there further questions? I'm going to propose that we take some time to develop those amendments and bring this back for a look at a later date. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 405. And I would... I have notified the sponsor of Senate Bill 760 that we were going to start a little later. I hope we can get him back here. We have to get along with that young man. I lived with him for a lot of years. So if you'll pardon us, we're just going to take a short break here before we start our hearing on Senate Bill 760.
Do SGR 7?
Well, we could do that. I'm going to open a work session on SGR 7. I believe that's a bill that's clean, has no amendments. I'd like to see it moved. Does it go to Ways and Means or to the floor?
Revenue.
Goes to revenue. Referral to revenue. The chair would entertain a motion.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move SGR 7 to revenue with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette has moved SJR 7 to revenue with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Perriola.
The Revenue Committee or
Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's one clarification made. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Clerk, to the bank.
Clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Decker? Senator
Farioli?
Aye.
Senator Chuck?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, SGR 7 has moved to the Senate Revenue Committee. We were going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 760, Senator Starr, Senator B. Starr.
Senator Starr, the junior Senator Starr. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Starr, State Senator, District 15 from Hillsboro. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 760. This is a simple bill that builds on the current statute as it relates to charter schools. Introduced this bill not at the request of anybody or any organization, but as an opportunity to perhaps begin or maybe continue a conversation about strengthening the relationship that parents, teachers, administrators, community members can have with their local school boards, and provide local school boards additional tools and opportunities to reach out to members in their communities. What the bill does is it broadens the opportunities for public school districts to become charter school districts. The bill that was the charter school bill, Senate Bill 100, I believe it was. Is that right?
Yeah. Just remember, I think that's correct, though.
Yeah. It provided that public school districts, if they incorporated one school, could become a public charter school district. This bill would allow an entire district to become a charter district, or more than one school within the district to become a charter schools within that district. And I recognize the political winds that blow in this building probably mean that this bill is before its time to a certain extent. But I think it's important to continue to have a conversation of ways that we can strengthen local control within the school districts. And I think this is one that provides school boards more choices and more opportunities to provide educational services to kids in the district that they represent. And that's the primary motivation, primary reason for me to have introduced this bill. And I appreciate the committee having a hearing on it. One of the issues is that the charter school law as it is introduced provides great flexibility and opportunities for some innovation and creativity as it relates to educating children in this state. And my sense is if charter schools are good for a certain number of youngsters in a district, perhaps there are school boards and members of the community that would like to have that opportunity for more youngsters within their community, and this provides that opportunity. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions, and appreciate the opportunity to testify before you this afternoon.
I'm wondering if this bill passed and the district became a charter district, would it still have the authority for bonding new construction and or other provisions of the state school funding mechanism? Would they receive the full ADMW as opposed to what occurs with most charter startups?
That's a very good question, and I think that the answer would be yes to that question.
Thank you. I believe that's what is proposed here, and it changes the outlook and the opportunity for success of the charter markedly if they receive those benefits along with the right to charter. So, any further questions? We have
thank you very much.
A couple of other witnesses signed up. Lori Wimmer, Whalen, Joni Gillis. Anyone else want to testify?
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. And we just wanted to point out a couple concerns we have with this bill. We participated in a work group on a similar concept 2 years ago and struggled with some of the various provisions. And unfortunately, I don't have my file with me on that one today where I would go into more detail about it. But as I recall, there were some irresolvable dilemmas with respect to making this work that we struggled with and were unable to resolve. And the bill ultimately died as a result. So I'd just like to put that on the record. And I could get back to you on the specifics if you should desire them in the future. We're worried that it's a possibility that by having a whole school district convert to a charter school district, that might not expand choice
but rather limit choice to the extent that students who would prefer a regular school program, if they were in what I would theorize would most likely be a small, rural, remote type district, struggling financially anyway, looking at turning itself into a charter district as a way of staying alive, for example, might in fact not really provide opportunity, even though it says in the bill itself that part of the criteria the board would have to take a look at is whether or not alternatives would be provided for students in the existing school that would be looking to convert if for practical matter there aren't schools nearby for those students to go to, for that matter for the staff who chose not to be part of a charter school to go to. That would be an irresolvable dilemma for that district. And I have heard a lot of arguments in favor of this that begin from the premise that some districts are so small and operating on the margins and having such a difficult time financially that this would be the reason they'd look to being a chartered district to survive. And there are a couple responses Oregon Education Association would have to that. If they are not financially viable for whatever reason, that's a separate and distinct issue from becoming a charter school for the opportunities of innovation and choice and so forth. And those ought to be addressed head on. And if the problem is money, then so too is the solution, not charter status. We also are worried then, therefore, that what we end up with is a district that is converting for the purpose of trying to save themselves from going away altogether, such as the Eddyville School did. And hoping for those federal funds to help save them in the interim, maybe having to compete against other charter starters for them and maybe not having a guarantee of getting those federal funds. And then after that period, even if they were to, getting the 90%, which is what I believe if the state is sponsoring it, they would be entitled to the 90% of ADMW. So they would actually be getting fewer dollars from the state, not the same amount as they were getting now, and still struggling financially. So they're getting up to a less advantageous financial position ultimately than they were at when they were struggling and looking to this as a remedy. So to us, the numbers may not pencil out if finances is the reason for converting. We also would draw your attention to Section 9 of the bill, which would direct the Department of Education to go out at least annually and, in effect, audit the charter district to make sure that they're in compliance with the provisions of the law. And we would ask for a fiscal impact statement to be done with respect to what kind of a cost burden that would put on the state for having that monitoring requirement for charter districts. And also, we would have trouble with Section 12 in the bill that, by virtue of turning an entire school district into a charter school district, would thereby diminish the professional accountability of the workforce by requiring that only 50% of them be licensed. It's an objection we had with Senate Bill 100. It's an objection we have today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? I have... one of the statements that you made regarding the finances, we've assumed in our charter legislation that charters by design can operate for a lower cost. And so we give them less money. And in fact, as much as 50% if we look at all funds. And so why wouldn't it be advantageous for a small school to function as a charter and still receive the benefits of full funding?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, and I would take it on faith that that were the case if it weren't for the fact that in every other charter school bill hearing I sit through, I hear from the charter starters that they're having trouble and struggling financially with respect to that, and that's why the last bill came before you, is they want out from under some of the requirements.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Joni Gillis with the Oregon Department of Education. Charter schools are schools of choice. The original legislative intent of Senate Bill 100 was to create public charter schools as legitimate avenues for parents, community members, educators to take responsible risks to create innovative and more flexible ways of educating children within the public school system. The current law, Senate Bill 100, allows the students to opt in. It expands choices for parents, it expands choices for teachers and for students. But it is a concern of the department that this bill might limit choices for parents, students, and teachers. If an entire district became a charter district, it might shut off the choice of a student or a parent wanting their child to go to a traditional non-chartered school within the resident school district. And we believe that this could create some hardship for parents. If an entire district was a charter district, then they would have to choose to go to another school outside the district. The intent of the bill, I think, is a good one, and I think it follows along with Senate Bill 100 to provide innovative opportunities. However, I would suggest that the 10% cap that was sunsetted in January of this year that would allow any number of students in a district to attend a public charter school, that might be one way that a school, it's not limiting a school board to say we want two or three of our schools to become charter schools and still use the charter school law for innovation and flexibility, but not to have the entire district convert to a charter district. Any questions?
Any questions? Thank you. You brought us some interesting ideas. I would invite Rob Kramer to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I didn't come here today intending to testify on this issue, but it is an issue which I've paid attention to over the years during my experience in charter schools. And I'd like to point out kind of a philosophic or conceptual framework for how to think about this bill. Senate Bill 100, Charter Schools, sets up a framework in which we can have a different relationship between a school and a school district. Rather than a school be operated and owned by a school district and all the employees be employees of the school district, in a traditional charter school arrangement, the charter school is not operated by the district but operates somewhat independently on a performance contract with the district, and they make a trade for accountability, types of accountability. Rather than being accountable for complying with rules that come from the state and district, they are accountable for their results. And as long as those results are met, they are allowed release from some of the regulations that apply to other schools. Now, this bill, as I understand it, and I have read the bill, would create a similar type of new accountability arrangement between districts and the state. Okay. If a charter school district was created and a district was in effect a charter district, the types of schools that it operates might not change at all. There might be no visible change from the perspective of the people who go to those schools. We are simply changing the accountability relationship with this bill between the district and the state, in essence allowing a waiver from many of the regulations that other districts comply with in exchange for heightened accountability arrangements or performance guarantees. So it really is simply changing the relationship between two governing bodies, just as Senate Bill 100 changed relationships between schools and districts. This bill would change the relationship between districts and the state. So I don't believe it would have any impact whatever on the ability or the availability of choices at the local school building level. Those schools would continue to operate very much like they had prior. But it's just simply a different accountability relationship, and one I think that has merit and should be explored. But that's all I have to say.
Any questions?
Can I ask one question on that?
Yes, please.
On the previous. Here's my thinking. My thinking on the previous one was the first thing seems fine to me, of allowing, if it's a charter school district, on the municipal accounting, to me it seems like it should have the same standard, and I know we're sending this to Ways and Means, so if you want to amend it or however, to me it just seems like you should have the same books on both, and it just makes inherent sense that you would do it that way.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, I can see that it would make sense from a 30,000-foot level looking down on it, and it does kind of have some intuitive sense that, you know, we should all do the same type of accounting, and then the books would meld together easily. But there are compelling reasons why the municipal accounting format doesn't fit what the charter schools do and the types of accounting that they use. I kind of liken it to, if I were to go for a checkup to a doctor, I wouldn't go to an OBGYN, I would go to a family practice doctor, because that doesn't fit my particular arrangement.
Very good illustration.
There you go.
Try another one.
I thought people would like that back there. The charter schools, when they do financial reporting to the districts, they report their finances in the same accounting line items that the districts use, and then the districts take that data, put it into their data to report up to the state. And so that gets accomplished anyway. We're talking about how they do their internal books and how those books get audited and what kind of financial audits make sense for those. So I think that what you're wishing for, that we have the reporting consistent between the school and the district, which gets sent up to the state, that happens anyway, external to the audit question.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would just want to ensure that when you, you know, 10 years from now, that you had just standard books now, so that you could go back and we could review and we'd be able to, with some level of certainty, be able to look at X charter school, X school district, and the books would look the same. So I might have a problem with that portion of the bill by myself, supportive of the PERS portion.
Further question. With charter districts, I think it's a provision of the charter school legislation law that students can opt into for that charter school. If we had charter districts, would it not follow that students from out of district could opt in as and become qualified then for ADMW to the charter district?
Mr. Chair, I believe it would. It would have the implicit effect of opening up district boundaries across districts and therefore enhancing choice in that manner as well.
In fact, 2 years ago when I introduced such legislation, it was one local rural district who was losing numbers that thought if they chartered that they might be able to entice students and thus preserve what is a very vital community school. Any other questions? We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 760. And with that, we're going to adjourn the Senate Education Committee.
Are we doing SJR 7? We did it? Okay.
You're carrying.
We moved it to revenue, so you're getting it anyway. Ryan, I'm glad you could drop.